Who are you? The Who. Connie Willis here on Coast to Coast AM. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to like the show of all. And we've got the best guests. We've got the best people working. The entire team is awesome. And we have an incredible website too at coasttocoastam.com. Now, our next guest coming up that we're going to be talking to for the next couple of hours is Bruce Maccabee. So go ahead and go over to our website and learn a whole lot about him there as you hear him talking. You know, if you're not laying in bed right now, I know a lot of people lay in bed and listen, but if you're up and you get a chance to check out on your phone or check out on your tablet that you've got, or maybe you've got the laptop right there, you can see where Bruce has sent us some pictures, and you can look at some of the things he's going to be talking about as we discuss them tonight. Very interesting stuff. I'm telling you what, this dude, he is amazing. He is, I mean, he is particular. He is very particular, and that's what you need to be when you're finding out this information as he did. He's just very particular with the facts and what he's found, and that's why he is who he is, and why it's an honor to be able to talk to him tonight. So go check out our website and see and look at the pictures that Bruce has sent us while we talk to him, and also check out where George is going to be, check out what our next shows are going to be, and check out how to be a Coast Insider. We've got it all there, coasttocoastam.com. With stations all over the U.S., North America, Puerto Rico, Guam, and by satellite, we are Coast to Coast AM. Connie Willis here, broadcasting out of one of our many affiliates, KOA News Radio, Denver. Okay, our next guest here. Let's get right to it. Now, he has been around for a long time, and he has a ton of information that he has given us. It is an honor to talk with him. He is very well respected in the UFO world, and he's a pretty nice guy too, by the way. So I want to make sure I give all his little credentials out because I think it's worthy and he deserves it for sure. A lot of times I like to go really quick and get to them. But for those of you that have never heard about Bruce, let me give you some of the information. A long career at the Naval Surface Warfare Center. He's worked on optical data processing, generation of underwater sound with lasers and various aspects of the Strategic Defense Initiative and ballistic missile defense using high-power lasers. It's always amazing to me the background of the people that really get into studying the UFOs, because they're major, I mean, they're really intelligent people that get into this, and all of a sudden, you know, they're learning and finding out information on UFOs. That's significant. He has been active in UFO research since the late 1960s. He joined the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena and was active in research and investigation for NICAP, what I just said, until its demise in 1980. So he's been doing this for a while. He became a member of MUFON back in 75 and appointed to the position of State Director for Maryland. I think he still holds that, at least the information I got at the time, it had said that. In 79, he was a part of establishing the Fund for UFO Research and was the chairman for about 13 years. He presently serves on the national board of the fund. His UFO research and investigations, extensive, very particular as well, incredibly detailed. He has also done historical research and was the first to obtain the flying disc file of the FBI. That's the real X-Files, folks. He's authored and co-authored many books, many articles. If you go looking him up, you're going to see a ton of things. He's listed also in the Who's Who in Technology Today and American Men and Women of Science. Another big thing. You know, this is not just some guy called out of, you know, pulled out himself out of a rock and he's saying UFOs, UFOs, UFOs. No, I mean, you have to see his stuff. It is so meticulous. I was reading some of this stuff preparing for tonight with the green lights, and I couldn't, I mean, every sentence, nothing was thrown away. Every sentence was used to throw something at you, more information at you. It was amazing. He's appeared on a lot of radio and TV shows. He's been around for a long time in documentaries. You've seen him before. And you know what is even cooler? He's an accomplished pianist and organist. And I think that is really awesome. And I had fun talking with him just to meet him for the first time. I've always seen his work, but it was great to chat with him beforehand. And I only talk a little bit because I don't, you know, I don't want to mess up the show. So we talked and we even laughed at a few jokes. And so anyway, let's welcome in Bruce Maccabee. Welcome, Bruce. It's an honor to have you here on Coast to Coast.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be asked to be on the Coast to Coast. Coast to Coast, a short direction across the United States, and a long direction by heading eastward from New York City and going around the earth until you get back to Los Angeles.
There you go.
Your bumper music made me think I should write another song called Who Am I?
That's, well, could you sing it too? Or would you do it by piano or organ, and would you sing along with it?
I wouldn't try to sing it.
Pianist, not singer, right? I gotcha.
I'd invert the melody for the Who Are You?
Well, bring it on.
Come out with you. Who am I?
Who? Yeah, well, maybe we can get them to sing it. Are they still around? Can they do that? But you got to play the piano. So Bruce, it is, I know there's a bazillion things we can talk to you about because you have written so much. It's amazing. I had asked, can we talk specifically, because I was very interested in these green lights that you have written about, these green fireballs. And I guess really, one of the things I do like to do is I like to study all the different genres and try to pull them together. Now, I don't know that this blends in with any of the other things, but I just want to throw it out there because you've written this information. And I just want to tell you why it's important to me. So, you know, you talk to ghost people. They have all these little weird orbs and things flashing around. You talk to Bigfoot people. There's orbs and little things flashing around. You talk to UFO people. There's orbs and little green flashes and different things popping around. Even people that do out-of-body experiences, they get these little, you know, light flashes too. Don't think that that's part of this. Don't know. I don't think so. But you tell me about these green lights that you've written about and that they've been seen. And it's still unsolved.
Yes, it's still an unsolved mystery. The green fireballs became noticed. Apparently there had been occasional things happening in the years preceding December of 1948. But in December of 1948, was on the 5th or 6th of December, whatever the exact date was, they had like a dozen fireballs go over, and these were seen over the southwestern United States. One of the most amazing things about the green fireballs was that they were concentrated over the next 2 years, concentrated over the southwestern United States, and hardly any reports of green fireballs in other parts of the world. So anyway, the people who took note of these things in particular were the security guards around our sensitive installations having to do with atomic energy, like a Hanford plant in the state of Washington, where they made atomic materials. And Los Alamos, New Mexico, where they designed bombs, and Texas, Fort Hood, Texas, where they stored atomic bombs that had been made. And in March of 1979, there were lots of little, well, not necessarily so little, size of a basketball up to maybe 10 or 20 feet, throwing spherical things that were moving around in the woods. But this was embedded in a much larger period of time in which some new unknown phenomena had started, and that's the phenomena that we call flying saucers. That goes back to the spring of 1947, when a number of people scattered throughout the United States saw these strange objects going through the sky, and so thought, well, it must be that the Air Force has got some new type of aircraft flying. They didn't tell people about it. A witness wouldn't be likely to tell somebody about it because they didn't want to be considered to be crazy. A sphere was flying through the sky or a flat disc-shaped thing. It wasn't until Kenneth Arnold saw some, had a really good sighting where he made some measurements of these objects as far as he could do by visual measurements. Came up with 1,700 miles an hour for these flat, semicircular-shaped things traveling along at wobbling, abrupt wobbling manner, like skipping a stone in the water or skipping a saucer in the water. And he assumed there was something from the Air Force, but he couldn't imagine how they could get it to fly. He couldn't see any engines, and he couldn't see any wings or tail or stuff that's normal on an aircraft, a fuselage. So he told his friends about it, and he was had a lot of credibility because of being involved in flying for years. So they tended to believe what he was saying in terms of just describing these objects, and it got into the newspapers. This is a whole story, which is in the book 3 Minutes in June, which I wrote a couple of years ago. And this was the beginning of the what has been called the flying saucer craze. Nowadays, we emphasize the July 8th events surrounding the Roswell crash.
Right.
But if you were to but it's important to realize that although that would have been the answer to all the mysteries of what's going on, if he could get the answer, the fact is that General Ramey stomped on the story about the Roswell crash so hard that it was bottled up in a day and didn't become a subject for discussion for another 30 years, not until 1978-79 time frame, when Stan Friedman first picked up on Jesse Marcel's claims that he had held pieces of a flying saucer. But back at the time of 1947, what was impressive was the number of sightings reported in the newspapers, probably over 1,000 sightings. The Air Force managed to collect a dozen, or maybe a dozen and a half, that were reasonably good, some involving pilots and so on. So this started off the phenomenon of having strange things flying through the sky. And that started in June of 1947. By the fall of 1947, the Air Force, top Air Force people had decided that these things were real, but they couldn't really tell the American people about them because there wasn't anything they could do about it.
They still should have told us, though, you know? They still should have told us. They can't do anything about it either.
Yeah, right. There were a number of possible explanations, or explanations that were considered for these reports. Typically, a person would make a report, and some guru know-it-all would try to explain it away. And in some cases, maybe 80% of the cases, the explanation could be logical. I mean, people can misidentify balloons and birds, aircraft, and all sorts of stuff that's flying through the sky.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the Air Force had enough reports from pilots and people of technical training that they began studying these things. As of September of 1947, top levels people had concluded that these things were real, and they just didn't know what they signified, where they came from, what they were doing, and all that. So they set up a project called Project Sign, which began in the January of 1948 and continued through 48, with sightings continually coming in, but nowhere near as the rate that it happened. When it started in June 24th, or late June of 47, and went through the first couple of weeks of July, there was maybe 1,000 sightings during that period of time. And then the sighting rate dropped off precipitously. And people may have thought the whole thing was over, but the Air Force knew that it wasn't. They were continually getting a dozen or so reports in a month. In the spring and summer of 1948, they had collected a couple hundred sightings and analyzed them. It took one sighting, the Childs Wooded sighting, which, by the way, was portrayed in the first installment of the Project Blue Book show that's on TV on the History Channel. The Charles Wittes sighting was enough to put over the top the idea that these things could be extraterrestrial. So the people who are doing this analysis at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the Air Materiel Command, were professional scientists and engineers who are very familiar with all sorts of flying crafts and so on. And they, the characteristics of motion and shape and so on of these things that were being reported, they couldn't figure out how they work and so on. So they decided that these things must be, they're not ours. They didn't think they were by anybody on Earth, so to speak. So they came from the outside. And they tried to convince General Chief of Staff of the Air Force at the time in September of 1947, Hoyt Vandenberg. They tried to convince him that these things were real and perhaps interplanetary, which is a term that was being used, interplanetary. And Vandenberg shot him down, said he didn't believe it or he didn't want them to talk about it or whatever. Whatever it was he said to the people, effectively removed interplanetary from the list of possible identifications of these objects. You had birds, weather phenomena, planes, all sorts of things, whatever, balloons, anything that could be up in the atmosphere traveling along as a misidentification, and there might be some hoaxes, and there might be some people who are just plain delusional.
Yeah.
There's a finite list of possible identifications for any particular UFO sighting. And one of the potential lists was interplanetary, but Vandenberg rejected that and essentially told the guy, sorry, wrong answer, come back with another answer. That forced the Project Sign and follow-on projects, Grudge and Project Blue Book, to try to shoehorn every sighting into some sort of an explanation, no matter whether the explanation made any sense or not.
Right. Too bad. Terrible decision making there.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that's my opinion on it.
By the fall of 1948, the idea of, cigar-shaped or circular or spherical things flying through the air was pretty well ingrained into the psyche of people, I guess. They weren't surprised to hear sightings, saucer reports.
Mm-hmm.
And now these green fireballs acted like some a sidebar chapter in the long history of flying saucers. The history of flying saucers sort of starts in June of 1947 and continues after that. The Air Force participation supposedly ended in 1969 when they closed Project Blue Book. We're learning that they kept stuff going anyway, which would be the logical thing to do. But anyway, the green fireball mystery was a mystery that lasted about 2 years, starting in December of 1948, with a bang, except there wasn't any noise, which is one of the things that they couldn't understand. One of the first people to get interested was a guy, Lincoln La Paz, who was a very famous meteoricist, somebody who studies meteors. And he had logged sightings of hundreds of meteors over his lifetime. He was involved with the Air Force. And
I want you to hold on to that there, Bruce, because we're going to come back and we're going to hear about these green fireballs that you're talking about. We just have to take a quick break here. Bruce McAbee talking with us here, Connie Willis too. It's Coast to Coast AM, and we're talking about the green fireballs. Stay with us. A very interesting show here on Coast to Coast AM once again. I always like to say the real theater of the mind that happens in radio, and that's absolutely true. We are talking with the UFO encyclopedia that actually has audio and talks, and that is Bruce McAbee. Bruce, so right before we took off for some commercials, you were just starting to talk about these green lights. And if I can ask, what was the behavior of these lights? And when you do talk about green or fireball, excuse me, what was the behavior of them? And when you say, hey, they were green, does that also, is that also significant in any way whatsoever that there may be, may have been and may still be some other colors?
Well, there were occasionally other colors. It started off being green. Some people had said there was green, like the, almost like the green in a go light, as opposed to a stoplight being red. You know, the green of the lights. The meteorologist, Langdon Paz, said that he had not seen meteors that were this color before. But they had several unique characteristics. After about 2 weeks, they had enough reports so that they were able to characterize these things as coming from the north or northwest, heading southward. They were mostly seen by the guards around these military installations that I was telling you about, Los Alamos, Sandia Laboratory, Sandia Base, near Kirtland Air Force Base at Albuquerque. And then they showed up at Fort Hood, Killeen Base, where atomic bombs were stored.
And this is what the saucers were doing too, correct?
Saucers were going around doing their thing, but the green fireballs are like a sort of a distinctly different phenomenon from the metallic-looking saucers.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were first seen, the early witnesses were surprised to see these things come from the north, and sometimes they appear to go from a high altitude down to a lower altitude, and then flatten off and run horizontally parallel to the surface of the earth until they either faded out or just sort of drooped a little bit and burned out at the end or whatever, they turned off. The term fireball related to meteors is probably not correct for these objects, but that's the term that everybody used, because initially they thought they were strange fireballs. But they had characteristics that the fireballs don't have. First of all, let me say to you, a fireball is just a big meteor. A bigger, instead of being a tiny grain of sand type, or which is a typical meteor, a little teeny thing, fireballs are chunks that might be the size of your finger, or maybe the size of your fist, and then you have super-duper bolides that are big enough to cause it blow up, explode, and before they land, if they do land. But these green fireball things, realizing the fireballs is not the exact term you should use for them, because they were different from typical meteor fireballs. But these green lights coming, one guy saw one come in from a high altitude, and we're talking about tens of thousands of feet, dropping downwards, and then all of a sudden it turned enough to travel horizontally parallel to the horizon.
Wow. That's not a meteorite, is it?
Yeah, right. The meteorologist, Lincoln LaPaz, was one of the witnesses in one case where he was able to triangulate, because some other people saw it too. And he got the directions they looked by plotting on a map everybody's position and direction. You could do a reasonable triangulation and find that they were traveling a few miles above the earth at speeds that were up to 10 miles per second. So they were going at meteoric speeds, but at the same time, they weren't making any noise. When LaPaz pointed out that when a really big meteor, like a fireball type, is breaking the sound barrier by many times over as it goes traveling through the atmosphere, creates a big shock wave. It can be heard. Nobody ever heard anything from these green fireballs And one of the big puzzlers was that these things were concentrated in the southwest of the United States, and there were hardly any green fireballs anywhere else. Now, when you think about it, that doesn't make any sense. Ordinary meteors and meteor showers are when the Earth goes through already existing volume of space where there are meteors that are presumably from a previous something that blew up into little pieces, and a whole bunch of pieces are traveling along in an orbit. The meteors are in an orbit at the same time the Earth is in orbit. If the Earth's orbit crosses the meteor orbit, then you get meteors. And in the December of every year, you have Geminid meteors that seem to, if you go out and watch the meteors, they seem to come from the constellation Gemini. And La Paz said he had seen over his lifetime 400 sub-meteors, the Gemini meteor shower. None of them were green. They're all faint, and none were green.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen anything green in the skies, ever. Myself, and I look up all the time.
Well, how many meteors have you seen?
I've seen quite a few. It's really cool. When you see them, like I had lived off of Florida at one point, and I was on the beach all the time looking up in the middle of the night all the time, and I'd see really unbelievable things. And being out in Kentucky and some of the other areas, just always looking up in the darkest of skies. And so I've been lucky enough, because I do look up, to see a lot of really cool things, but I've never seen anything like this. Of course, I haven't been in those areas where these things kind of like to be.
Well, yeah, right. But the meteor showers appear over the whole surface of the Earth.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think you've pretty much established these are not meteorites.
You're out there on the beach of some lake with a Kentucky gentleman, right?
I'm not saying anything. But
these fireballs started to, they started off with a bang, about a dozen one night, and then over the next couple of weeks, there were typically a fireball or two every night. By the time February rolled around, the security agencies were all in an uproar saying, what could this be? They're afraid that somebody might be setting up flares or worse than that. La Paz said they're not real meteors. There's something, if it's not, La Paz said, if this isn't some super duper development of the Air Force, then we have to assume that they are from the Soviet Union, and they could be what would be called a fractional orbital bomb, where essentially you send this rocket up at a high altitude, tens of miles, and it goes into an orbit or approximate orbit around the Earth, and then you bring it out of orbit where you want it to fall. And La Paz said he believes that if these things were launched in the Soviet Union, it would take them like 15 minutes to get to the southwest of the United States by coming over the pole, so to speak. And he was really worried that they could be Russian, and so they would be, they might have spies on the ground in the areas where these things were. The spies would be keeping track of the green fireballs, seeing where they go down, and then tell the people who are watching them, essentially get the range and directions just right to drop bombs on our military installations.
Can I ask you something about that, Bruce?
Uh-huh.
At this point in time, in that year, in all those years, did the military always simply think that it must be the enemy? Did they ever once think it could have been from somewhere else? Is their first thought always, it's just human and it's an enemy?
Well, this is a perfect example of what they did with the green fireballs. The green fireballs were a phenomenon unto themselves, not like the metallic-looking flying saucers,
Right,
but they
absolutely.
were fireballs, and they shouldn't exist. The arguments that La Paz said fireballs don't concentrate in a certain place on the Earth. After all, the Earth is moving through space around the sun, and the Earth is rotating. So New Mexico and Texas and Nevada and all these places where the green fireballs are landing, those are locations which are circling their a path through the space around the sun. The idea of going through a meteor shower really is going through a broad area of orbit of a bunch of little particles that are pretty well staying together in one big orbit. But they would be seen all over the Earth, not just in one place.
Right.
These things were seen in one place over periods of weeks and months. In February, they had a meeting of some famous scientists, including Edward Teller, and the military security people. And La Paz laid out the arguments that he had for them not to be normal meteors, the wrong color. The color was unusual. Of course, this tendency to flatten out and travel horizontally before dying was not a characteristic of a meteor. Being concentrated in one small area of the Earth made no sense at all from the point of view of trying to compare these things to the meteor shower.
Right.
So the reaction of the Air Force itself was that although this expert in the subject was saying these aren't meteors, they didn't, the top Air Force people were not really that anxious to set up a project to study these green meteors. Their arguments seem to be, well, they're going to turn out to be natural phenomena anyway. We're not worried. And it didn't make much sense that they weren't worried because you had things that happened, like, for example, at Fort Hood, Texas, Killeen Base, where they stored atomic bombs. For a period of time in March of 1949, they had what might be called nowadays glowing orbs. Some things being small, but they typical design define them as being something like the size of a tennis ball or the size of a basketball at arm's length. This gets to be pretty big if the objects are distance away. And they had a period of time of a couple of weeks there where there were so many sightings that they set up a measurement, a capability to make triangulation measurements. These glowing balls would just sort of be like aimlessly floating through the sky and moving along in one direction and turning and going in another direction and so on. It was really, really bizarre. And what was equally bizarre was the people seeing these things, everybody believed they were there because there were just too many professional observers seeing them. But the again, the top levels of the Air Force and so on were reluctant to do anything about it. It wasn't until the fall of 1949 that one of the science advisors, a guy named Kaplan, science advisor to the Air Force, managed to convince the Air Force to spend a little bit of money on trying to find out something about these fireballs and the what they also call the saucer variation.
Right.
Amusing terminology because the saucers had come first, and the green fireballs were the variation. Anyway, the green fireballs were the impetus for setting up the project called Twinkle. The project Twinkle.
I like that name.
Sort of superimposed upon the flying saucer phenomenon. The green fireballs were unknowns like the saucers. They could fly around. They didn't go very fast. They just suddenly appear, move around somewhat, and then disappear somehow, turn off or whatever. So late 1949, this scientist finally convinced the Air Force that they ought to spend some money on trying to find out what the green fireballs were, characterize them in some way or other. And that led to this Project Twinkle. And the beginning of Project Twinkle was in the springtime of 1950. And when they set up some telescopes called cinephotolites, it makes a movie. Instead of being just looking through the telescope with your eyeball, you're making a movie through the telescope. And you're also having measurements of the altitude, the angular elevation, and azimuth, the direction around the horizontal, whether you're looking left, right. The azimuth is the angle with respect to north. So if you can get the azimuth and altitude from two different locations, you can triangulate. Actually, all you need is the elevation and azimuth at one location, and either the elevation or azimuth at another location.
Right.
You can go and do a triangulation.
Yeah.
The triangulation will tell you how far away something is, and then if you use the image on the movie film that recorded this on the Cine Theodolite, you look at the image size and you know the focal length of the telescope. And the triangulation tells you how far away the object is. You can calculate how big it is.
Well, you're actually also telling me that they have pictures of these and even video of these or film of these.
Not video, but movies.
Yeah, film, right. I'd like to see those.
Yeah, so would I. So would everybody. And if you look at the paper on my website about the White Sands proof, you can go to brumac.mysite.com/whitesandsproof/whitesandsproof.html.
You can also go to coasttocoastam.com, and you'll also see some of the pictures that we've got in there, too, on that we featured for Bruce tonight. So, hey, more to come as Bruce continues to tell us, Bruce McAbee, about these green lights and what they might be about here. Thanks for listening. It's Coast to Coast AM that you're listening to. I'm Connie Willis.